Well, good evening. Welcome on behalf of the editorial team and our publishers, Routledge, to the Ethnic and Racial Studies Journal lecture. My name's Martin Bulmer and I'm the editor of the journal. This is the 9th lecture in a series which began in 1992 as part of the LSE Public Lecture Programme, which is now an annual event. We're grateful to the London School of Economics for providing the venue. For many years, the journal was published here before moving to the sociology department at the University of Surrey, where we're now based. We're glad to be here, and we're very much looking forward to the lecture which is to follow. We're grateful to the LSE Gender Institute for assistance in publicising the lecture, given its focus on gender. In the year of the LSE's humiliation in the Industrial Tribunal over the Helen Mercer case, it's particularly appropriate that we're also here to redress the balance and demonstrate again that the school takes gender seriously. It's my great pleasure to introduce our speaker this evening, Patricia Hill Collins. Patricia is one of the leading sociologists in the United States of America who's taken a particular interest in issues of race and gender and their intersection. She is well known for her writing on the subject in books such as Black Feminist Thought, Knowledge, Consciousness, and the Politics of Experience, and Fighting Words, Black Women and the Search for Justice. Some of you have heard her before in Britain at the British Sociological Association Conference or the ERS 20th Anniversary Conference in 1997. We're delighted to welcome her back. Patricia is Charles Phelps Taft Professor of Sociology in the Department of African American Studies at the University of Cincinnati. She's currently chair of that department, as well as a former council member of the American Sociological Association, and we're grateful that she's taken time away from those duties to be here this evening. Her subject, which she will explain to us, is entitled Like One of the Family, Race, Ethnicity, and the Paradox of U.S. National Identity. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Patricia Hill Collins.
Good evening. I apologize to those of you in the first two rows who I cannot see. If I were taller, I could speak to all of you at the same time. I am a rather informal speaker. I have a prepared talk with me today, and what I am likely to do is read and discuss part of my talk. I'm going to sketch out an argument, but I want you to be aware that this argument is still a work in progress. It's fairly near completion, but I am still thinking through some of the connections that I'm trying to make in this particular paper. So after my presentation, we will have a discussion, question, comment, period, and I would very much like to hear your ideas about what I say today. How is everyone this evening? Now, I'm incredibly flattered that you came because I know you have all kinds of other wonderful things to do, like sleep, eat, and hang out with your friends, all right? So it's very nice to see you here this evening. My talk is entitled Like One of the Family, Race, Ethnicity, and the Paradox of American National Identity. And what I'm trying to do in this particular paper is think through, theoretically, some of the connections between race, class, ethnicity, nation, and gender. I think these ideas are very tightly bundled, and they socially construct one another. So for quite some time, I've been searching for ways to develop arguments that investigate these intersections. In this particular paper, I'll be looking at the whole idea of family, and I begin this paper with a vignette. Much of my work is grounded in the experiences of African American women, not because I think African American women are better than anyone else, although there are African American women who would argue that. I am not one of them. But because I think when you theorize from a grounded position, from a particular social location, you are able to get an angle of vision that is not available from the abstract terrain of the so-called God's eye view. So the vignette that I bring to you today is from a work entitled Like One of the Family. It is written by Alice Childress, who is a forgotten African-American, or largely forgotten, African-American woman writer. And Alice Childress created something that is really quite unusual in the political economy of intellectual production in the United States. An African-American writer writing to an African-American audience through a medium controlled by African-Americans. In this case, a black newspaper in the 50s and in the 40s, put together by Paul Robeson. Some of you may have heard of him. Now, these are 62 fictional monologues written by, or that Alice Childress creates, where in these monologues she creates the whole character of Mildred, who is speaking to her friend. So when Mildred goes out into the world, she comes back and she tells her friend Marge about all of the things that she's seen and done. This vignette is taken from Like One of the Family. "Hi, Marge. I have had me one hectic day. Well, I had to take out my crystal ball and give Mrs. C a thorough reading." She's the boss, Mrs. C. "Well, she's a pretty nice woman as they go, and I have never had too much trouble with her. But from time to time, she really gripes me with her ways. Today, she had a girlfriend of hers over to lunch, and I was real busy afterwards clearing the things away. And she called me over and introduced me to the woman. Oh, no, Marge, I didn't object to that at all. I greeted the lady and then went back to my work. And then it started. I could hear her talking just as loud, and she says to her friend, 'We just love her. She's like one of the family, and she just adores our little Carol. We don't know what we'd do without her. We don't think of her as a servant.' And on she went. And every time I came in to move a plate off the table, both of them would grin at me like Chessie cats." Now, the above passage from Like One of the Family suggests two important themes concerning the relation among race, ethnicity, and U.S. national identity. The first is how different racial ethnic groups perceive the differential treatment that routinely accompanies differential citizenship categories. This vignette suggests two views of the meaning of race and ethnicity in U.S. society, one advanced by more powerful groups who minimize its importance, and the other by less powerful groups who have limited venues to advance alternative arguments. The superficial dialogue between Mrs. C and Mildred is just as Mrs. C wants it, pinioning Mildred within the framework of a beloved yet second-class family member allows Mrs. C to ignore the power relations linking the two women. Moreover, Mrs. C's reliance on seemingly natural authority structures within her understanding of the meaning of family allows her to mask the real power involved. The qualifier "like" is crucial here, for it signals the power of Mrs. C to define what family means and position Mildred within her definition of a normal family. As long as Mildred knows her place in the family as a subordinated worker, she can stay. Understandings of American national identity, with citizenship marking categories of belonging, resonate with similar themes. Mrs. C's perception that she treated Mildred like she was one of her family mirrors widespread beliefs among white Americans that African Americans, Native Americans, Chicanos, Puerto Ricans, and other historically oppressed racial ethnic groups are treated equally enough within U.S. society. This is not a politics of exclusion, but one of containment. American non-whites are like us. They are connected to us. But they are not us, such views suggest. In this context, as Mrs. C's verbosity and Mildred's forced silences reveal, white Americans rarely get to hear uncensored views expressed by African Americans on their seemingly shared American experiences. Mrs. C's words in this passage also signal a second important theme, namely the significance of family rhetoric in normalizing and naturalizing this entire process. Unlike feminist analyses that blame white men for racial oppression, yet remain strangely silent concerning white women's culpability, Childress's passage reveals how racial power operates among women. By this move, she implicates both men and women in constructing racial inequality and introduces an important gender analysis into discussions of U.S. citizenship. Within prevailing logic, because family relations are often seen as private matters, both families and the women associated with them are thought to fall outside public sphere activities that legislate racial, ethnic, and citizenship classifications. Yet treating women as the only group where gender matters and relegating them to the seemingly private sphere of the family effectively removes gender from important political questions concerning race, ethnicity, and U.S. citizenship. By depicting how racial hierarchy is constructed and naturalized within a family setting, Childress's vignette dissolves this public-private binary. Instead, Childress's fiction encourages us to examine the dual function of family. Family operates as an ideological construction that masks power relations, namely, the ideas invoked by Mrs. C to position Mildred as a subordinate family member. At the same time, family constitutes a fundamental principle of social organization. Mrs. C and Mildred are members of different families marked by race and class differences, and that difference makes a difference. Using the experiences of African American women such as Mildred as a touchstone, I explore how this construct of U.S. black women as like one of the family, in other words, legally part of the U.S. nation state, but holding second-class citizenship within it, fosters our understanding of the connections among race, ethnicity, and U.S. national identity. Mildred's predicament illustrates a fundamental paradox of U.S. national identity, namely, how the promise of individual rights guaranteed to her via U.S. law remains juxtaposed to the reality of the differential group treatment she receives due to her race, gender, and class, among other categories. Mildred's situation also provides important clues to how these relations become seen as normal and natural, as well as the significance of family rhetoric and practices to these twin normalization and naturalization processes. Now, let me sketch out the argument. Do you have a sense of what the paper actually is setting out to do? You do? These British audiences, I don't know what to make of you all. The only time it's been more difficult has been the Finnish audience, when no one moved. It really worried me. And then afterwards they said, oh, we liked what you said. But I said, how would I have known that? All right. I am going to attempt to work with this cultural difference and tell you a little bit about the paper that I'm sketching out here. First of all, the paper is organized in three sections. In the first section, I look at some basic information about race, ethnicity, and U.S. national identity. And what I'm particularly interested in that section is how is it that the U.S. can undergo such massive social reorganization, which it has since its inception, and yet maintain racial hierarchies in such a fixed fashion? What we have is a curious juxtaposition of continuity and change. And I'm going to argue that race and ethnicity are quite central to that process. And that is really also providing some of the basic vocabulary. Many of you will be familiar with this, but some of you may not. In the second section of the paper, I'd like to talk a little bit about the American family ideal. Many of you will be familiar with that and not with the first part of the paper. And basically what I'm interested in looking at this American family ideal is how it normalizes and naturalizes racial hierarchy. How is it invoked? How is it used? The phrase that you might listen for is the phrase hierarchy within unity. How families are projected as a unified body, and yet within that unity there is a natural hierarchy, and how that natural hierarchy in many ways becomes a template for our understandings of other kinds of hierarchy. And then in the third section of the paper, I would like to broaden that analysis and link the American family ideal to the question of U.S. national identity. How does this notion of the American family ideal as a template for hierarchy within unity connect back with ideas of U.S. national identity? How does it become a framework both for ideological practices and actual social organization? And again, we can talk about some of this later on. So on continuity and change, I'm going to read a little bit here so that I do not lose my train of thought. race, ethnicity, and U.S. national identity. French philosopher Étienne Balibar identifies two interrelated forms of racism that appear across diverse societies. The first that he identifies is something called external racisms, and these are racisms directed at groups who seemingly fall outside the imagined or actual neighborhood, region, nation state, or home territory of a seemingly superior racial group. As racisms of elimination or extermination, external racisms find expression through ideas and practices designed to maintain the homogeneity of the home space. They operate by purifying of a society of the threat that seemingly inferior races may represent. Expressed via practices such as xenophobia, genocide, or so-called ethnic cleansing, external racisms aim to remove undesirable races from what is seen as privileged home space. In contrast, internal racisms occur when powerful racial groups include seemingly inferior racial groups within society, yet also subordinate those same groups. Practices associated with internal racisms oppress or exploit seemingly inferior racial groups to benefit more powerful racial groups. As racisms of oppression and exploitation, internal racisms find expression through ideas and practices that partition society into social groups and that maintain social hierarchies using these group identities. Expressed via practices such as colonialism, apartheid, and racial segregation, internal racisms aim to control seemingly inferior racial groups within what is seen as privileged home space. Now, while analytically distinct, neither form typically appears by itself, and external and internal racisms remain deeply intertwined. For example, external and internal racisms can reinforce one another within the boundaries of pre-existing nation states. If you look at, for example, yesterday I had the opportunity to visit the Imperial War Museum and visit the new exhibit on the Holocaust, which is a very good example of the intertwining of external and internal racisms in terms of how they actually work together. And since I am here in the UK, I think this is an audience that is fairly familiar, I would hope, with the notion of colonialism, the external, internal racism combination there. Now, what I'm interested in is what happens when these dual racisms become integral to the founding moments of a nation state, when they are not just annexed on after the fact, but where they are fundamental to that nation state's national identity from its inception. National identity itself can become so compromised by such deeply embedded racial processes that it becomes difficult to conceive of national identity in terms other than racial. I would argue that the formation of the United States as a nation state, sadly, reflects this tightly bundled nexus of external, internal racism, and national identity. In forming a white settler society, European immigrants who founded American colonies saw their search for land and resources as their right as a new people or nation. And during the colonial period, you see the forming of a core triangle, I would argue, between white immigrant groups, native peoples, and enslaved Africans, who represent a very interesting relationship among white, black, and Native Americans, or native peoples, and a particular combination of internal and external racisms that are bundled with the very identity of the nation itself. Native peoples encountered the external racism of being treated as foreign peoples or nations initially conquered and often exterminated in warfare, and who were subsequently subordinated via public policies dedicated to their exclusion. Enslaved Africans encountered the internal racism of being commodified and exchanged on the marketplace, then exploited via manual and reproductive labor. The latter racial group was needed, the former was not. Moreover, these interconnections among European immigrant groups, native peoples, and African peoples not only form the template for constructing categories of U.S. citizenship, the first-class white citizen, the foreigner who stands outside citizenship, and the intergenerationally subordinated second-class black citizen. The relationship among these three groups became fixed as essential ingredients for a fundamentally racialized American national identity. Obviously, you see the difference between what I'm describing here and democratic principles and the Constitution, all men are created equal, we're all individuals in front of the law, etc. Now, What I would argue happened during this process is what you had to do is collapse various ethnicities within each of these racial categories into racial categories, so that English, French, Norwegian, Germans, Irish became white Americans, whose power eventually allowed them to erase whiteness as a visible identity category, thus becoming just plain old Americans. This did not allow them to erase class differences, such that whites have class, but they do not have race. Cherokee, Sioux, Navajo, Pueblo became Indians or Native Americans. These would be considered ethnic groups or peoples who were removed from the body politic and ghettoized in quasi-autonomous colonies of reservations. Igbo, Yoruba, Fulani, Fon became enslaved Africans, then slaves, then niggers, who upon migration to cities encountered a parallel process of ghettoization, first visited upon Native peoples. Both Native and blacks had race. They did not, and they stood as proxy for class in this particular setting. Thus, the three founding racial groups of whites, Indians, and slaves enshrined in U.S. law and custom required collapsing multiple ethnicities assigned to each overarching racial category to create the very racial categories themselves. Racial categories were constructed in relation to one another and from the stuff of pre-existing ethnicities. Now, I cite this because in the United States, there is a tradition of race is one field of study, and ethnicity is a completely different field of study historically. And very often, ethnicity has been coded as white. Only white groups had ethnicity initially, which they shed upon the process of becoming American. What I'm arguing here is something quite different. I'm really talking about the intertwining situation of race and ethnicity and how it's foundational to national identity and the formation of the country. Now, as markers of citizenship rights, racial categories frame different ways of belonging to the nation state itself. First-class citizenship for propertied whites, an ambiguous citizenship status for Native Americans, which is still contested, and second-class citizenship for people of African descent. Moreover, the relationships among these three racial groups not only were integral to the inception of U.S. national identity and its codification in the founding of the nation state, these same categories became increasingly reworked or repeatedly reworked in response to the exigencies of subsequent historical periods. So this is what's very interesting to me about American or U.S. history. What you find during the period of massive European immigration is a reworking of these categories. The racial categories themselves grow and shrink and shift and change. What does remain fairly constant is the need to have the categorizations itself. Now, groups who migrate into this paradoxical situation face the challenge of negotiating these identities. And I would argue that the whole process of white immigrant groups, or so-called white immigrant groups of migrating into this situation, it's not as if groups automatically accepted racial identity as it is set up in the United States. As Noel, I can't pronounce this gentleman's name, Ignatieff, does anybody know how to say that? Did I say that correctly? Thank you. I've only read it, I've never said it before in public. Excuse me, I should have practiced that before I came here. All right? Reminds us in his book, How the Irish Became White, the answers to these questions were far from clear cut. I mean, it was difficult for some groups to make that shift from being a subordinated race in a different nation state to move to the United States and discover that they could become a privileged group by shedding that ethnicity and embracing a new racial identity that isn't a racial identity at all. African Americans forced to watch this Americanization process that erased ethnicity as the price of belonging often found this to be a bitter pill to swallow. In a wrap on race with anthropologist Margaret Mead, African-American author James Baldwin describes the significance of race in definitions of American. He says this, "I had my fill of seeing people come down the gangplank on Wednesday, let us say, speaking not a word of English, and by Friday discovering that I was working for them, and they were calling me nigger like everybody else, so that the Italian adventure, or even the Jewish adventure, however grim, is distinguished from my own adventure by one thing. Not only am I black, I am one of our niggers. Americans can treat me in a certain way because I am an American. They would never treat an African the way they treat me." Now, this is going to be a very important passage for a bit later on in the presentation. But I could talk a bit more about this process because the United States is currently undergoing a very interesting period of time that some call the so-called Browning of America, where these racial categories are being reformulated yet again. But what I would argue is that when the dust settles, unless we intervene, we'll see the same triangle of white, black, native in the same relationships to one another, regardless of where individuals choose to situate themselves in that. Now, my question, let me move on to the next part of the paper, which is the American family ideal, normalizing and naturalizing racial hierarchy. How do we come to see this as normal and natural? Why don't people notice this more often? How does this replicate itself over time, repeatedly? And I would argue that what we might do now is shift location and look to some feminist debates about the family, because they begin to shed light on how this naturalization and normalization process happens. Contemporary debates about gender hierarchies have identified the ways in which family rhetoric concerning an American family ideal contributes to women's oppression. Defined as a natural or biological, first of all, how many of you know about this? Should I even read this part? Do you know this part? Okay, I won't read this part. All right. If you don't know this part, talk to the person next to you who does know this part, all right? But basically, what the feminist argument begins to say is, family is a site not of a natural biological arrangement, but of a socially constructed power, situation of power, that is directly tied in to women's subordination in wider society. Things that we consider to be natural and normal in terms of heterosexual couples who produce their own biological children are social constructions. Things that we consider to be natural and normal, a well-functioning family protecting and balancing the interests of all of its members, mothers and fathers care for children, adults care for their elderly parents, husbands care for wives, and everyone contributes to and benefits from family membership in proportion to his or her capacities, in fact, is a structure that is quite central to manufacturing hierarchy. Despite this seeming unity of interest among family members, hierarchies not only exist, but are deemed to be natural and necessary for family survival. Normal families have a natural authority structure, the father head earning an adequate family wage, a stay-at-home wife, and children. Now, those who idealize this family form as a private haven from a public world see family as held together by primarily emotional bonds of love and caring across this natural authority structure. People are in a natural authority structure, and they love one another within this natural authority structure. Are you beginning to hear the resonating words of Mrs. C saying, oh, we just love Mildred, all right? She just loves our Carol. The need to reproduce those emotional bonds to mask these relationships. Also, I'd point out that this traditional American family ideal assumes a relatively fixed sexual division of labor, wherein women's roles are defined primarily in terms of reproductive labor in the home and men's in the public world of work. And what this tends to do is it begins to establish the difference between the public and the private sphere and to genderize the public and private spheres in ways that make the public sphere male and the private sphere female. Now, the significance of the American family ideal for gender hierarchy suggests that family rhetoric might also function for other social hierarchies. And that's what I want to play around with right here for a minute. Family rhetoric reappears to normalize and naturalize social hierarchies of class and age, among others. For example, in Alice Childress's vignette, Mrs. C needed to believe that Mildred was, in fact, like one of the family. This belief enabled Mrs. C to ignore the obvious class exploitation inherent in generations of Mildreds working for generations of Mrs. C's, as well as Mrs. C's own culpability in these class relations. Beliefs about the naturalness of hierarchy within family allowed her to normalize the contradictions of first and second class citizenship, distinguishing her life chances from those afforded Mildred. In this sense, this particular family rhetoric legitimates hierarchies within family households who contain biologically joined family members, as well as members of households who come and go, who perform work for those families. At the same time, it lays the foundation for social hierarchies that use family households as their building blocks For example, racially segregated housing in the United States is quite significant in the class politics of the United States. So this whole notion of family obscuring class relations or helping to structure class relations. You'll often hear in the United States things like, oh, it's not that I wanted to move away from the black people. It wasn't anything personal against them. It was for my family, right? Or it was just property values to maintain the value of my house. That kind of thing is something you hear fairly frequently. Age is another structure where family rhetoric can serve to mask this natural hierarchy. And in this case, I'd like to call your attention to the whole notion of seniority structures. Families technically have seniority structures. The old can tell the young what to do. Any of you who've had older siblings who told you what to do and you resented it. Part of what made that whole structure natural and normal was he was born first, or she was born first, or he got here first, or she got here first. Therefore, first gets more power. Now, interestingly, I think this ties in quite nicely with questions of seniority in the labor market. The whole notion of first hired, last fired is a principle of the seniority system. So what that tends to ignore is the discrimination that might have occurred in prior periods of time when there was not fair competition. In a similar fashion, you'll hear things like this in terms of property relations. One field that is growing dramatically in American sociology is an investigation of wealth. The Americans have finally caught up to the British in some ways on this, and have discovered data such as black American families have, or white American families have 10 times the wealth as black American families, and are stunned by this. But this is explained if you look at intergenerational accumulation of wealth. The notion that whites who got here first got the wealth and blacks who came last didn't, and that's fair because it happened in the past. It's a seniority system in terms of when one arrives in the country. Someone would expect to see those who arrived first have more. Well, obviously, this is a flawed argument, but it is an argument that is used quite prominently in many different circles. Now, social hierarchies rely on these practices. And these are practices, or rely on distinctive practices. Let me back up. Social hierarchies such as gender, age, and class, the three that I'm talking about right now, rely on practices that in some ways resemble yet differ from those associated with external and internal racisms. Now let me just cluster some of these social hierarchies together for a minute and then come back and hopefully pull this together. On the one hand, hierarchies of race, ethnicity, and class deploy exclusionary practices designed to keep families separated from one another, right? These are the oppressions that say, you go over there, you go over there, your family is there, my family is here. They're practices of segregation. Exclusionary mechanisms invoke notions of group purity. The goal is to remove members of the subordinate group from the group receiving social benefits. Families organized around putatively homogeneous racial, ethnic, or class groupings are seen as having a unity of interest that distinguishes them from others. In U.S. society, racially, ethnically, and class homogeneous family units have been segregated from one another and ranked based on their seeming normality and deviancy. In this system, families such as Mildred's become marked with the intergenerational stigma of inherited deviancy and are segregated based on this assumed abnormality. In contrast, hierarchies of gender, sexuality, and age rely more heavily on inclusionary practices that subordinate members within individual family units. Reminiscent of the practices associated with internal racisms, these forms of constructing hierarchy work with the theme of difference, assuming that the different are in close proximity to one another, and that this difference must be contained, hierarchically arranged, and managed. Now, they are really twinned together. These are intertwining practices, this whole external and internal racisms, or practices of exclusion and inclusion. But I'm trying to unpack them because they really speak to the use of family in very different ways. So let me move on and say a little bit about that. Now, the naturalization process, pulling this back together again. Using a series of interrelated exclusionary and inclusionary practices, the rhetoric associated with the American family ideal naturalizes and normalizes racial and ethnic meanings in the United States. One important component of the naturalization process concerns how presumptions of blood ties frame the perceived links among blood, family, kin, and race. In the United States, concepts of family and kinship draw strength from the flow of blood as a substance that regulates the spread of rights. While the legal system is deeply implicated in legitimating marriages for heterosexual partners, the importance given to the seemingly natural bonds between mothers and children, brothers and sisters, grandmothers and grandchildren, signal the importance of blood in crafting biological and therefore naturalized definitions of family. Representing the genetic links among related individuals, the belief in blood ties naturalizes the bonds among members of kinship networks. And this, I would argue, is why gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgendered individuals become very, very threatening, far beyond their numbers. Because what these individuals tend to do in terms of being approximate threat is they disrupt the seeming naturalness of these blood ties and bloodlines. You see, this is something that's supposed to flow normally from heterosexuality. And if it doesn't flow normally, and someone says, you know, that's socially constructed, this becomes very problematic. It's disrupting this entire process of reproduction and blood ties and construction of family and construction of race at its inception. It's a real challenge to the American family ideal. Now, given the significance attached to biology, women of different racial ethnic groups have varying responsibilities in maintaining these seemingly natural blood ties. For example, women like Mrs. C play a special role in keeping family bloodlines pure. Prior to contemporary reproductive technologies, creating white families required controlling white women's sexuality, largely through social norms that advocated premarital virginity. By marrying white men and engaging in sexual relations only with their husbands, white women ensured the racial purity of white families. Thus, through social taboos that eschewed premarital sexuality and interracial marriage for white women, white families could thereby avoid racial degeneration. Now, when inserted into naturalized hierarchies of gender, race, class, and nation, and institutionally reinforced via mechanisms such as racially segregated space and state-sanctioned violence, efforts to regulate sexuality and marriage reinforce beliefs in the sanctity of blood ties. Historically, we see a similar process in maintaining racial categories, which I would argue that whole language of family is quite prominent in how people talk about race. Race and family also can be seen as interchangeable language. We can talk a bit more about that later. Let me move on to the third section of the paper and begin to connect some of this together, because I'm basically just sort of giving you bullets from without the argument, and hopefully I'm still making a tad bit of sense. Are you still there? You still awake? I like to check from time to time. Although I do understand that audiences here have a very high toleration for boredom. You have perfected that art of sleeping with your eyes open. I've heard about that. So, you never know. But let me move on and connect up the American family ideal and U.S. national identity. If the U.S. nation state is conceptualized as an American national family, patterned after the American family ideal, then the standards used to assess the contributions of family members in idealized families become foundational for assessing group contributions to U.S. national well-being. Within this logic, Black Americans and Native peoples become the domestic others. They are like one of the family. Whereas racial ethnic immigrants become the foreign Blacks and Latino immigrants for whom other strategies of control are reserved. A curious reversal takes place. Native-born or domestic Blacks and Native peoples become quasi-women because they are seen as property of the men in the family, or of the state in this case. They become recoded as a proximate threat. Just as women are required for the idealized family and subordinated within it, you can't have a family without women, all right? Just as women are required for the idealized family and subordinated within it, on the nation state level, Black difference and deviance remains necessary yet must be subordinated. In contrast, foreign-born Blacks and Latinos become the true outsiders, those who must be contained via exclusionary mechanisms, quarantined until they are proven worthy of entry into the national family. The irony is striking. Because domestic blacks and native peoples are natural, albeit subordinate, members of the national family, and because their subordination is integral to the triangular foundations of U.S. national identity itself, the need to keep them subordinated, and thus the national family intact, can be fought even more strenuously than the perceived threat of the new outsiders. Anthropologist Margaret Mead's response to James Baldwin's views on this Americanization process identifies the gendered foundation of how being like family fosters differential treatment and quite difficult treatment. Drawing a parallel between race and gender, Mead notes, quote, "Getting back to treating your own worse than other people, many men won't put up with from their wives what they will put up with from other women, because their wives are theirs, and they are going to stay home and do what their husbands want." Close quote. Within Mead's family property model, domestic Negroes and Native peoples become equated with wives within families. Blacks, Native peoples, and women become subject to property rules of others to be disposed of and ruled as those others see fit. And you see this kind of flowing with notions like the childlike wife, the innocent woman, sort of the connections of children and women and what that means when it becomes annexed to racial categories, which I mentioned are constructed from the stuff of ethnicity in a lot of ways. Now, let me say a few things about this whole naturalization and normalization process on the national level and not just on the family level. First are the connections between family and citizenship, how people understand citizenship. I would argue they understand it through family language. Naturalized hierarchies learned in family units influence understandings of citizenship. Common sense understandings of family suggest that individuals feel that they owe something to and are responsible for members of their family. For example, some of you may have family members who are just totally unworthy. They may borrow money from you, they may come and take your car and wreck it, they may sleep in your house, they may eat your food, they may show up unannounced, but they're still family, so you feel you owe them something. Or you feel you have a relationship with them. In some fashion, you have to deal with them. This whole notion of responsibility toward, ownership over, accountability to, is something that we take with us from our understanding of family members. It doesn't have anything to do with merit very often. It really has to do with just because we're blood. Just because we're family, just because we belong. And I would argue that citizenship categories imply a similar logic. But when that whole logic becomes racialized, as it has in the United States, you have virtually permanent first and second class citizenship treatment, because those blood ties underlie that understanding of citizenship in some very fundamental ways, which is why I started with the whole triangular relationship, so we would not be distracted by the multiple groups of color who are now in the United States. It's not about color, it's about power, all right? A second theme that I think we might want to think about a tad more has to do with the entitlements of birth, right? Birth is something, when you're born into a family, it's a permanent status. You can't get put out if you're born into the family, somehow. That's seen to be some kind of natural, normal, biological, and in the case of the United States, permanent arrangement. Now, my question is, individual merit, again, doesn't really matter. If you're a member of the family by birth, and that would be by race, you're entitled to certain things, and you are excluded from others. Those of you who might be disbelievers on this account might just look at the differential treatment afforded African-American children in inner-city schools in the United States and white suburban children who are primarily middle class in the United States. Now, the merit of the individual child is really not relevant. What is quite relevant is where one lives, all right? Where one's family lives, where that family home place is. And from the location of the family grow a whole series of benefits that are quite astounding, right? So I don't have to say much more about that, but I think that's a pretty good case of, regardless of what the law says, you see, we've had cases, Brown versus Board of Education from 1954, that argued that all citizens are equal, that segregation is wrong, and yet somehow it has reformulated itself without race being mentioned as a major theme. Another theme that we might consider in looking at this whole citizenship category is the significance, and this is a related thing, the significance of family, space, and property in maintaining this entire notion of U.S. national identity and how it's racialized, how it works in gender-specific ways. The logic here is that all families belong and races belong in certain places. That is your place, your neighborhood, this is my place, my neighborhood, your family belongs there, my family belongs here. The whole notion of we each have our own home space. And this grows very much from the notion of family space as private home space that should not be invaded by outsiders. It is the stuff for which wars have been fought to maintain the integrity of family borders, to maintain the integrity of national borders, you see. And also, a final issue here under this particular section of the paper, as is the case with all situations of hierarchy, actual or implicit use of force, sanctions, and violence may be needed to maintain unequal power relations. People do not go willingly into hierarchy, usually. There are uprisings, there is fussing, there is carrying on, there is complaining. So that force is very often used to teach these relationships or to maintain these relationships. And very often, when we look at these naturalized and normalized situations, the force is explained away by family business. All right, family secrets, don't talk about it, keep it quiet. We're just gonna beat up on our domestic black folks, and the only reason you find out about it is when you have a particularly egregious case. For example, the case of Rodney King in Los Angeles, which precipitated a riot, would be a very good example. Or in the situation of force and violence against women, rape is a tool of sexual terrorism, as many feminists would argue. And that is a form of violence that has great difficulty being taken seriously, because it's often folded into this understanding of family violence. Well, did she know her attacker? What was she wearing? What was going on? What was their relationship, etc.? Or in the case of children and incest, again, you're in that family, very hidden family violence. So family becomes language that's very malleable to some that can often be annexed onto this whole notion of force in some very interesting ways. Now, there what I've done is just sketched out just the broad parameters of the argument. There's obviously a lot in between that if you were a diligent reader, I would pass out the entire paper to you. Don't ask, because it's not ready to be passed out. So I'll scribble down. I can't do that. All right? Are you still awake out there? All right, let's finish up. Concluding remarks. Apparently, I have a few concluding remarks. Are you ready for me to conclude? Let's try not to cheer out here. All right, the speaker is about ready to conclude. Then we all go, yay. No, we're not going to do that. All right? Anyhow, backing up. Addressing the paradox within U.S. national identity that juxtaposes individual rights to group discrimination requires listening to those with different interpretations of how family rhetoric knits together hierarchies of race, ethnicity, gender, and nation. Embedded in Alice Childress's words, given to Mildred, lie a series of ideas that typically remain suppressed because they are advanced by less powerful groups. After hearing Mrs. C's claims that Mildred was like one of the family, Mildred proclaimed, quote, Mrs. C, I want to have a talk with you, close quote. And in that talk, Mildred provides a rich challenge to dominant constructions of race, ethnicity, and the meaning of belonging. First and foremost, Mildred rejects her subordination within the family. Radical idea. People who are oppressed don't like it, all right? They don't love it, right? Mildred rejects her subordination within the family. She is not seduced by the promise of better treatment afforded her because, unlike her black women counterparts who are not allowed in Mrs. C's house, she is like one of the family, domestic foreign-born blacks. Quote, Mrs. C, you are a pretty nice person to work for, but I wish you would please stop talking about me like I was a cocker spaniel or a kitten. Now, you just sit there and hear me out. In the first place, you do not love me. You may be fond of me, but that is all. In the second place, I am not just like one of the family at all. The family eats in the dining room and I eat in the kitchen. Your mama borrows your lace tablecloth for her company, and your son entertains his friends in your parlor. Your daughter takes her afternoon nap on the living room couch, and the puppy sleeps on your satin spread. So you can see I am not just like one of the family. Rejecting her objectification in this passage, Mildred clearly describes the distinctions between first and second class citizenship in the C family, and points out that the benefits of full membership are denied to her. Moreover, Mildred identifies two dimensions of second-class citizenship, the ways in which black women have been subordinated within this language of family. Mildred claims that black women can be used as pets to serve at the whim of more powerful whites, or as mules, beasts of burden, to perform the labor that makes the assumed family norm possible at all. She identifies both and rejects both. Mildred then moves on to detail how many of the ideas attributed to her concerning her acceptance of her subordinate status are just that, ideas attributed to her by more powerful groups who need ideologies such as the American family ideal to mask the actual power relationships. Take, for example, her explicit rejection of the black mammy role, one that vests black women as having unlimited love and affection for their white children. Note how Mildred refutes this particular race-gender relationship among U.S. black and white women. Here's what she says. Now for another thing, I do not just adore your little Carol. I think she is a likable child, but she is also fresh and sassy. I know you call it uninhibited, and that is the way you want your child to be, but luckily, my mother taught me some inhibitions, or else I would smack little Carol once in a while when she's talking to you like you're a dog. But as it is, I just laugh it off the way you do, because she is your child, and I am not like one of the family. Now, this is a powerful rejection of dominant ideology of childcare that privileges children in white middle-class families. Speaking from her particular location, Mildred rejects dominant feminist ideologies that all women share a common feminist consciousness stemming from their relationships, their relation with motherhood or reproductive issues. Here, Mildred draws a line in the sand. Mrs. C stands on one side and Mildred on the other, because Mildred works for Mrs. C and must keep quiet in the face of practices concerning little Carol that she clearly does not condone. Mildred also challenges how Mrs. C's use of family rhetoric obscures class inequalities. In this case, Mrs. C wants to believe that Mildred is so happy to serve her that she would be flattered by Mrs. C missing her. Mildred is having none of that either. Here's what she says. Now, when you say, "We don't know what we do without her," this is a polite lie. Because I know if I drop dead or had a stroke, you would get somebody to replace me. You think it is a compliment when you say, "We don't think of her as a servant." But after I have worked myself into a sweat cleaning the bathroom in the kitchen, making the beds, cooking the lunch, washing the dishes, I do not feel like no weekend house guest. I feel like a servant. And in the face of that, I have been meaning to ask you for a slight raise, which will make me feel much better toward everyone here and make me know my work is appreciated. In the space of their conversation, Mildred was able to challenge not only ideas about race and gender that constructed her as lesser, but actual practices that fostered her economic subordination. Mildred not only refuted ideas that she was like one of the family, she asked for a raise while doing so. Via these actions, she points out that race talk can be dismissed in the absence of concrete actions that aim to redress past inequalities. No matter how much Mrs. C commiserated with Mildred's situation, finding more money and granting Mildred a raise might mean much more to Mildred than well-intended, albeit impotent, race talk. As Mildred reminds us, when it comes to the promises of American national identity, being like one of the family gets you close, but it is simply not good enough. Thank you.
Patricia has kindly agreed to answer questions, so we'll have a short period of questions and comment from the audience. Who would like to? I see a microphone there. Who would like to begin? Yeah? Some front row.
Hi. It seems like your view on, I guess, Indians, blacks, and white Americans is somewhat static. How would your sort of view of the world take into account growing success of Latinos and even Asian Indians in America, in fact, founding over a third of the Silicon Valley companies. How does that fit into your paradigm, which seems somewhat static and resistant to outsiders?
No, it's not that at all. I think what I'm saying is that I think we're in a very interesting period of reformulating American racial identity. That is what I think is going on. And I think Latinos and Asians, the whole browning of America, the diversification, I mean, there's certain groups that are involved in that. So there is a part of the paper that, in fact, talks about the diversification of these groups. What I am arguing, though, is I'm raising the question of whether these categories of white, black, and native are so fundamental to American national identity that they become the anchors around which all of these other groups must negotiate. So, for example, Asian Americans would be a very good group in terms of having to somehow negotiate between not being white, but being a model minority, right? Being not black. I mean, how does one position oneself if one is Asian and affluent vis-a-vis the racial politics of America? How does one position oneself if one is Latino and affluent in the racial politics of America? I don't know how this is going to come out. But what I am rejecting is the notion that race has gone away, that somehow because you have migration streams of people of color who represent the new immigration stream, that somehow ethnicity is now the major category, that somehow class and ethnicity are major, that we have a multiplicity of categories. What I would argue is that as long as I can look at demographic data that tell me that whites as a class, certainly not all whites, I'm clear about that, that blacks as a group, and that Native Americans as a group are going to be in a certain kind of relationship with one another, with those categories being elastic and changing in terms of what they mean. It certainly means something very different today to be black than it meant 50 years ago, you see. It's a power relationship that I'm talking about. It isn't just an identity relationship of individuals and how they actually relate to those changes. To me, what I'm describing is a fundamental power relationship that what I'm arguing in this paper is integral to how America understands itself as America. And by raising this question, what I'm hoping will happen is this is the question that gets engaged so that if in fact we change the definition of what it means to be American, it will no longer be anchored in these three points. So for example, new groups that come to the United States and they look and they say, do I want to be white? Do I want to be black? Do I want to be Asian? Native? I don't want to be any of those things. How do I position myself vis-a-vis those things and therefore change those things by the process that I'm going through? So I don't see this as static at all. I see it as a combination of continuity and change. It's a framework for talking about continuity and change. Go ahead.
No, I guess I'd argue that they want to be and all the economic power is flowing disproportionately to them as opposed to even sort of quasi-native whites. So I guess I'm trying to understand how the power is still being conveyed by your paradigm when in fact these new groups are not coming at the bottom of the totem pole.
No.
They're getting a disproportionate amount of power, and the current structure that you're talking about is not somehow keeping them back. I mean,
because the structure is not designed to keep them back. Oh, I'm sorry.
Let's have another question.
Actually, the mic would be helpful in terms of people speaking for themselves.
Yes. The gentleman at the back, get your hand up. You? No?
No, I was going to finish the question, but I wanted him to repeat it so that she could hear it.
Yeah.
That's where I thought we were. And then we'll come to you.
Do you want to repeat?
Briefly.
Can you speak?
No. I guess, you know, my question in general was, I was trying to understand the relevance of the argument you're laying out when it seems like the new ethnic groups seem to have a very disproportionate level of power, in fact, positively in their direction, and how does that fit into sort of what you're saying about the traditional class structure or sort of becoming white in America. It doesn't seem to matter, I guess. It doesn't seem to matter right now for a lot of the groups coming in.
That's exactly my point about foreign born. right? What I'm arguing is that there is something integral to native-born American in terms of white American, African American, as opposed to Afro-Caribbean, as opposed to new immigrants from Russia. There's something fundamental to what America is that requires a certain relationship among whites, blacks, and Native Americans. It's really quite pristine, you see. And your question about everybody wants to be green, of course they do. But does everybody have the same opportunities to be green, you see? There are structural barriers that are built in for African Americans and for Native Americans that in many ways are not there for other groups in the same way. There are different barriers. You can make a similar case about white immigrant groups, ethnic groups, coming from European countries, the wave of immigration in the early 20th century. So this argument that, let me just back up and say it this way. I find it very fascinating that a country that has a couple of hundred years of history, that has gone through profound changes in how it's organized, whether it's how it's organized in terms of space, how it's organized in terms of technology, the rise of the Silicon Valley, the fall of the Rust Belt, that whole thing, somehow manages to maintain these same racial categories. Somehow manages, in terms of where green is distributed, to redistribute green to white, or to those who can socially construct as white, and to redistribute green away from those who are black and native. Now that's an ugly thing to describe, I know, because it does not go along with the whole notion of, oh, things are different now. Well, they're different now, and they're the same. And what I'm trying to unpack is this whole relationship of continuity and change. And I'm focusing on continuity, which is not popular right now, you see, but it's real.
Okay, next question. Yep, over there. Oh. Yeah. Gentleman there, then here.
Okay. One of the things that impresses me about the United States is the extent to which the term community is used in a particular way in relation to residential areas and so on. It's a very emotive and vibrant word. I take it from your argument that you would see this and the use of the term community as a sort of extension of that of the family.
Yes.
Would that be right?
That would be. That would be. In fact, I think they flow very nicely together. Because what you have, this whole notion of community would be almost, when we talk about neighborhoods, an extended family space that is composed of families like one's own, whatever that likeness is. Now, class is certainly blurring this a little bit, but it's certainly, you know, I don't think we have a multicultural democracy where you see equal distribution of racial families, ethnic families, what all different kinds of families. So the notion of community is quite central. People feel that they are protecting their community. They feel that when it comes to blacks moving in particular, they are protecting their property values, their family values, their house, their way of life. There's quite a bit of research on this in terms of tipping points in neighborhoods, right? What happens when too many blacks move in, or too many Latinos move in, or too many of anything moves in? See, it's a very genteel process because no one talks about it quite this way, but that's the outcome. So I would say community is often used as a euphemism for what is being defended, when actually, to me, it is really a property relationship that is being defended.
Yep.
You said that, if I got that right, that the female family role on a national level is applied to blacks. Is this also true for black intellectuals like you or for black athletes, or are there any differences?
I think the issue of the categories that we encounter and how we attempt to play them out do apply to all blacks. I think the issue is one encounters that differently depending on where one is situated. So for example, you bring up the case of the black athlete. Black athletes, many of them, very small percentage, but they're very, very wealthy, right? Very affluent. And yet their affluence very often comes from the use of the body, not the use of the mind. The fact that they are recruited very young and trained to become superior embodied beings for entertainment and for sport. Now that's a very old racist trope that actually, I haven't talked about men very much in this paper, but that would be where I'd go with masculinity and use of the male body. black women a different history. I have a friend who talks about the situation that academic black women or black intellectual women are in. If I might use a term, I'm going to use the term. Do you think you can handle a term that's a little saucy or whatever? She describes it as the big tit syndrome. All right? That's how she describes it. I'm just letting you know. And she basically says what happens with black intellectual women or black academics is everybody wants to suck on the big tit. Basically, they want a mammy. All right? They want an academic mammy or an intellectual mammy or a corporate mammy who does her own job and who does the job of emotional labor, who pretends to be the Mildred, who just pretends to love everything, who's basically being exploited and who very often is paid less, even though it is considerably more than what many other people are making, all right? So when we look at this whole notion of one's place in the family and how that whole family rhetoric shapes our understandings of people's place, I think we could build a pretty compelling case that the place of black men and black women in the American family was in fact to do those very things. And that even today, among those who are affluent or who are middle class or who are poor, there are variations of how that happens now. It's no longer just a homogeneous situation. It is a more stratified situation. So, for example, poor black women may still be doing the domestic work, but it may be routinized and it may be in fast food establishments. It's specialized cooking and cleaning, et cetera. Working class black women may be doing domestic work where they're expected, may be doing clerical work and administrative support functions where they're expected to be the mammy. And intellectual women, same thing. These roots run very deep.
Mary Song?
I really liked your paper very much. I was just hoping to ask you for clarification on a particular point. You were suggesting in your talk, if I understood you correctly, that there seems that you think there's a big difference between the treatment of native blacks, as you put it, and foreign-born immigrants, including foreign blacks.
Right.
And I was hoping that you might clarify this a little bit, because from what I've read, there seems to be a lot of empirical evidence to show that even foreign blacks actually have faced real limitations in terms of how much they're able to actually distance themselves from racialization into a black underclass, and a lot of empirical evidence by Mary Waters and Hernandez Kelly, all these
exactly.
people show that the
second generation
get incorporated into this.
That's exactly,
black minority
I think
status.
You're exactly on point with that. I mean, I think it's difficult to migrate to the United States and be physically African or be physically of African descent in some fashion, whether one is from the continent or from Latin countries, and avoid this whole racialization process. It is much more difficult to find a place. I find it very interesting that the last or a major wave of foreign-born blacks from the Caribbean in the 1920s encountered that exact same reality. And they were quite central in forming the Garvey movement, who were made up of African Americans and Caribbean blacks who recognized their shared situation in terms of what it meant to be a black American, whether it was a long-term black American intergenerationally or first-generation African American. Now, I think today the situation is it's more complicated. There are more groups. It's a different economy. There's different technology. But the fundamental questions that confront immigrant groups of varying backgrounds in terms of how they are going to be incorporated into the American racial structure are very similar. We just don't know the answers as to what they're actually going to do. You see, will foreign-born blacks decide they're going to really try and maintain the separation from African Americans and construct a new identity and say, we're not like them, we're entrepreneurs, our children go to school, we're not engaged in crime, that kind of thing? What will be the relationships among Asians and blacks, which is a very interesting set of questions that are going on right now? What will be the relationships among Latinos and blacks and among different categories of Latinos? For example, Puerto Ricans have a whole history of nationalism in terms of what happened in Puerto Rico, whereas Cuban Americans have a very different migration stream in terms of who's going to speak for the Latino population. So it's a lot of this is up for grabs now. My concern is that other immigrant groups, particularly immigrant groups of color, not accept the racial triangle the way it sort of settles itself out, but in fact see that triangle for what it is and disrupt it, you see. Now, I don't know whether that's going to happen or not. see, I tend to be, I'm going to be pessimistic, so I'm prepared for bad news. But I would really like to keep my mind open and be optimistic for good news.
One more question, yeah, goodbye.
Thank you. I was interested in how you're using a story.
Can you speak into the mic?
I was interested in how you're using a story to find evidence of the position of the woman. And would you recommend that sort of work, where you look in a fiction, you could maybe evidence far more clearly the position of the subordinated groups?
Well, I think you have to look for, when you're doing work on subordinated groups who have not been allowed to speak or have not been allowed to have voice, you have to be quite resourceful in where you look. There are a lot of, I wouldn't necessarily, Martin, with all respect to you, I wouldn't necessarily look in ethnic and racial studies quite yet, all right? But maybe soon. So you one has to go to a variety of places and remain open-minded in terms of where one might find that, keeping in mind that that knowledge is probably going to be derogated, looked down upon, be identified as folk wisdom or just fiction or just someone's thought or a poem or all of those kinds of things. I tend to, in my work, what I try and do is legitimate those alternative sources, to first identify them, and it's a process of translation from those alternative sources to say, here's a holistic argument that in a lot of ways is very pristine. This like one of the family vignettes, is 3 pages long. She manages to say in these 3 pages things that I read books and books and books to get bits and pieces of, which I pull from other sources and cite copiously in the rest of the paper. But what she manages to do is pull together in this very short vignette, like one of the family, raise a whole series of questions about a series of hierarchies that I find very intriguing. So I try and remain open-minded to those things, and I would encourage, but we have to do what we have to do sometimes.
Well, I think I'd like to draw, is there a...
This one over here?
One more, and then we'll...
Hi. This is going to be a reflection of my biases, I think, but I started off listening when you started about natives, and I thought you meant Native Americans. Native peoples, indigenous peoples in Canada, in the United States, North America. And what my question is where do they fit in this nice, neat triangle? You've got a whole group of people who lay claim to the place, who have completely different visions of that national space, and I wonder how they fit into this construction of racial relations, identities, and national
identity. Many people think the Native Americans have disappeared. I mean, it's to the point where, the assumption is that the genocide was so complete that there are no more Native Americans. And quite frankly, it's really shameful, because one can see practices, if you look at the icons of sports teams in the United States, you see very negative portrayals of Native Americans that, indigenous folks that could not get away with in terms of black people. To me, at this point, indigenous people, Native peoples, are still in a contested relationship to the American national state. This is where nationalist ideology becomes quite central, in terms of we are a nation, we are a people, we have our land, we want to tax, but we have to deal with you because we're part of the United States, but we know we will never fully belong to the United States. So it's a very interesting contested relationship in terms of land, and also in terms of integration into the urban space, the urbanization of Native populations. You want to say more? Go ahead.
Could I just make a slight suggestion because I've been thinking about it myself, and I wonder what you think about it. It seems to me that the goals of indigenous peoples are actually quite different from those of Native black Americans or incoming black Americans. Namely, that rather than wanting to be integrated into that national vision, they quite want to be separated from that national vision. And I think that issue of actually not wanting to be part of the family at all, having refused to join, adds another dimension that might get us just advance what is already a very good argument a little bit closer to what is this national identity issue.
That's a really interesting point, because what it says is, in order for this national identity to work, why would anyone reject it? And why would anyone in his or her right mind reject it if he or she were already here? Can't you see that there are people dying to get to the United States, etc.? And yet Native peoples are turning their backs on this in a variety of ways. So clearly there has to be a way to pretend that these people don't matter, don't count, aren't enough of them, are crazy, etc. You see, but it really is an alternative vision of what it means to be, quite frankly, American. Mm. Still there.
Thank you.
Well, I think we should give the speaker a rest. I'd really like to say three things. First of all, Patricia, I'd like to thank you very much indeed for a most exciting and stimulating lecture. I think we'd all like to say thanks very much.
Oh, thank you.
Secondly, there will be an opportunity for you to read the lecture in its entirety, as it will be published in the January 2001 issue of the journal. Perhaps at this point I could also mention that our September 2000 issue, is a special issue on gender and ethnicity, edited by a member of our board, Hali Afshar, and her colleague at the University of York, Mary Maynard. So that will be coming out in September. And thirdly, I would like you to invite you to join us at our reception after the lecture, which will take place on the fifth floor of this building. So if you feel energetic, you can walk up the stairs or you can take the lift and then go through the swing doors on your right as you come out off the stairs and keep going, and you'll find a drink and opportunity to talk to each other and to the speaker. But thank you very much indeed, Patricia.